Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundtable of the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this week lawmakers continue to haggle over expanding Medicaid. But the delay is having life and death consequences for some Utahns, including a woman who recently died of colon cancer. We'll hear more about Carol in the healthcare gap. Also, state lawmakers learned this week that an experiment with hemp extracts is having promising results at the University of Utah. How will this affect the debate in the state legislature over legalizing medical marijuana? And the five primary candidates for Salt Lake City mayor debated homelessness, open space, public safety, and more. We'll get all the details from last night's debate. The week's top stories, plus Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines after the news. Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got Healthy Utah, medical marijuana, lesbian adoptions, and much more. And joining me this morning in studio, senior political reporter Robert Gerke is here. Hi, Robert.
Hi, good morning.
Also with us, government reporter Christopher Smart. Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
Editorial writer George Pyle is here as well.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And Justice reporter Jennifer Dobner joins us. And Jennifer, good morning to you.
Good morning, everyone.
And you can join us, too, with questions, comments about the week's news. Lots of news this week. You can send those to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter or Google+. Put your comments on the website sltrib.com. Or you can call us. 801-355-TALK is that number. 801-355-8255. Let's start with a dose of local politics. The Salt Lake City mayor's election is officially on. And last night, candidates gathered at the Tribune debate here at the City Library. Chris, as you noted in your recap story, the rhetoric is becoming more pointed against two-term incumbent Ralph Becker.
Well, yeah, so there, Ralph Becker has four challengers, and they've probably done a half a dozen debates by now. And I think they're all getting comfortable, you know, sort of running down the mayor and criticizing him, as well as each other more and more. And this comes on the heels of news that a political action committee has put up, you know, over a dozen billboards in favor of Jackie Biskupski. And she says that, you know, it wasn't her doing. She didn't know anything about it. The PAC is actually put together by Reagan Outdoor Advertising, an old foe and a bitter foe of Mayor Ralph Becker. And so Becker and another challenger, City Council Chairman Luke Garrett, criticized Biskupski last night for sort of, taking money politics to a new level in municipal races. This is the first time that a PAC has really been involved in Salt Lake City elections on the municipal level. And there is a limit for corporations and individuals in the mayor's race, and that limits $7,500. The 15 billboards there for women and children put them in elsewhere, in maybe, you know, satellite areas, so that it's not so heavily concentrated. And then the other thing that impacts that, of course, is law enforcement, and the Luke Garrett in particular. And George Chapman also castigated the mayor for not having enough cops on the street. And in fact, there was a lively debate earlier this year during the budget session when the council wanted more cops, and the former chief put his foot down and said, no, we don't need more cops. We can't arrest this our way out of this. We have to find other solutions. The council won out. It looks like we're going to get eight new cops and potentially 15 more. And that is because as the sort of crisis down by the road home increases, the police have been sucked out of other neighborhoods in the city, and now those neighborhoods are saying, hey, we need cops up here too. You know, the response times are too long. They don't see enough police on the street. And so you get this homelessness, public safety thing rolled up into one. And the mayor's got a commission looking at this. But it's really a tough nut to crack. And mm-hmm. it's something that after 7.5 years, Ralph Becker has to take responsibility for it.
We've got candidates tussling over open space, the homeless problem, public safety, a lot of hot issues. And George, I'm curious what you think about the tone of the rhetoric last night. I suppose it's easy for the two-term incumbent to become the whipping boy in any debate, but there were jabs among the other contenders as well.
Yes, and well, first, my compliments to you and your team and the library and the candidates for last night's debate. I think it was great. All the candidates got to kind of show their personal style and emphasize the issues they thought were important. Whenever you have an incumbent in the race, it does come down to a referendum on the incumbent. Do you want to stay with what you've got and the direction that's been set, or do you want to make a change? The way this system is set up, first we have a primary, so we have one Ralph and four not Ralphs. And only assuming that the incumbent makes it through the primary, which incumbents normally do, then the race is among the four not Ralphs to be the one not Ralph that will make it to the November election. That vote will be split, obviously, four ways, and it'll be interesting to see who comes out, and who comes out will determine to a large degree what the tone of the final race mm-hmm. will be. But, 4 years ago, nobody of any note, of any chance of winning, ran against Ralph Becker, and now, they're four really strong candidates. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really impressive, the people who came to run. And it would the greatest shame of all of this would be if the people who lose take their marbles and go home. I would really hope that all of these people, and I imagine they will, stay involved in local government, run for the city council, do something, because they all have a lot to contribute.
Absolutely.
And especially when you're talking about the homeless situation, I mean, it's easy for Ralph Becker to point to the success of the Housing First program and the success of the taking the homeless veterans off the street. I mean, Salt Lake City is being written up in liberal and conservative magazines all across the country as a success story in dealing with the homeless problem. But you walk out by Pioneer Park and you'd think they're talking about some other city. So they still have to get on top of that. The mayor is criticized by a lot of people for being aloof, for being absent, for being too removed from the day-to-day management. They blame the situation with the police chief and that getting out of hand on his management style and being off with the National League of Cities and rumors about him applying for various jobs in Washington and only deciding to run for a third term when he didn't get that job. These are just rumors. And so it is easy for somebody, even who really is the smartest guy in the room, to sort of wear out his welcome after a while. So the mail ballots are out. You have a chance to very thoughtfully mark yours and mail it back in. And it's the 11th.
It has to be postmarked by the 10th, I believe. Isn't it, Chris?
As long as they have it by the 11th. So you can mail it in or you can drop it off.
Mm-hmm. Have there been any polls? Do we have any sense of the horse race at this point?
There are no doubt lots of polls.
You don't know about them, huh?
I don't have privy to them, but I know that Ralph Becker polls on just about everything. And I'm sure that Jackie Biskupski has also been doing a fair share of polling. They're the ones who can afford to poll. The Tribune is in the process of putting together a poll, which will come out before the August 11th primary. And so it's assumed that the two with the most money are the two that are ahead. But we don't know that. And Luke Garrett's performance last night and his sort of low-key door-to-door campaign. I don't know. We'll just have to wait and see. I think To this point, however, that Becker and Biskupski have had the highest profile. Hmm.
In a campaign like this, in particular, where there's going to be very low voter turnout, it's all about, we touched on this last week, the vote-by-mail programs that these candidates are able to put together. And, you know, it costs a lot of money to put one of these together to go out and identify your supporters and get them ballots and follow up and make sure they mail them in. And so that's where this cash advantage that Ralph and Jackie have is a big issue for them. And I think that would indicate that, yeah, those are the two candidates that are most likely to come out of this primary, although in a low turnout election, surprises can happen. Mm.
There's the other dynamic, though, too, and this is both citywide and, but particularly District 4, where Derek Kitchen is running for a council seat. And, of course, he's the Kitchen in the famous court case, Kitchen versus Herbert, the gay marriage case. And so you have Jackie Biskupski, who's gay, and you have Derek Kitchen, who's gay, and you have Dave Robinson, the other mayor candidate, who's gay. So the gay community it could really be a force in what otherwise would be sort of a low turnout primary.
It's going to be very interesting 3 weeks to go. Thanks to KCPW for broadcasting the debate live. And again, if you missed it, it's available in video at sltrib.com. We need to take a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. Join us. 801-355-TALK is that number. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and joining me in studio, Robert Gerke, Jennifer Dobner, Christopher Smart, and George Pyle. And joining us now by phone is health reporter Kristen Moulton, who joins us from Northern Utah. And Kristen, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being here. You can join us too. Call 801-355-TALK or tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. Kristen, legislators met in interim meetings at the Capitol this week, and we got an update on Medicaid expansion, Healthy Utah, all the negotiations that have gone into that. What's the latest?
The latest is that there is no real news to report about from the Gang of Six, the governor, lieutenant governor, and legislative leaders who have been meeting since the session to come up with a compromise way to expand Medicaid for low-income people. And essentially, I mean, Senator Shiozawa gave more details, or I guess they're not really details, but sort of some of the main issues that they're looking at. But David Patton, the head of the health department, who's sort of staff for the Gang of Six, said that they have no concrete proposal. They have no plan that they're refining. They haven't even gotten there yet. And they had promised to be ready with a plan by the end of July. So, you know, for several weeks now, other people who are part of those talks have been saying they're not going to meet that deadline, and it's pretty clear they won't meet that deadline, but maybe they'll have in concept something by the end of July.
Meanwhile, people in the coverage gap keep waiting, and one woman in particular that you and Robert profiled this week illustrates the consequences of that delay. Tell us briefly about Carol Frisbee.
Carol was involved in the advocacy for Medicaid expansion. You know, this discussion's been going on for years. 3 years or so, the legislature has been talking and not doing anything, and she was one of the early people. She was on the state's PCN network, which is sort of a minimal insurance plan for low-income people. It doesn't allow for people to see specialists, so her doctor told her something was wrong in her gut and she should go to a specialist. She didn't because she couldn't pay for it out of pocket. Eventually she had colon cancer and she died this week. Mm-hmm. So anyway, and she was the second person who had actually been one of the advocates going up to the Capitol urging Medicaid expansion. We had a woman who was involved earlier who died of breast cancer last year who had been involved. And so anyway, I think Representative Dunnigan, who's you know, one of the key people in the legislature on this whole conversation, has has tipped his hat in all these discussions this week, saying, you know, we're aware of these people are bleeding. We know it's important, but we do want to get it right. Mm-hmm. So they know, anyway, they're aware of those people, but they have to insulate themselves from the individual heart-wrenching stories because they want to do good policy. That's how they put it.
Robert, how do you think that Carol's story, others like it, obviously there will be more, what does that do to the dynamics of the debate?
Well, it clearly puts a human face on the consequences of not moving ahead with a plan or putting a plan together. It's hard to say. I mean, it's hard to say for sure if the plan had been in place. I mean, she was diagnosed 21 months ago, so we're not talking about last session. We're talking about, you know, much earlier. But you know, the representatives acknowledge that, you know, this is something that does have, you know, as Kristen put it, does have consequences, dire consequences in some cases. Carol wrote a note to the House Speaker Greg Hughes, encouraging him, I guess, to sort of pull the trigger on a plan, and it was delivered to him during the House caucus the other day when Representative Ward, who's a doctor and a supporter of this, of Medicaid expansion, you know, announced to the caucus that she had died. To be blunt, there are some legislators some Republican legislators who I talk to who don't, they sort of resent being called out like that and being made to look like they are heartless people and that. And so there could be the political dynamic of it could be a little bit, it could backfire a little bit to sort of publicly shame them like this and you know, they aren't real happy about it.
Sure. Kristen mentioned that the Gang of Six is not going to meet the end of July deadline. What's the new target?
Well, so Representative Dunnigan says that he hopes that they can have something ready to go by the time the legislature meets again in January. So by the time the next general session rolls around, they are still a long ways away. I mean, when I was talking to Representative Dunnigan the other day, he said that they haven't cracked this whole, you know, do they expand just up to the poverty level or do they go to 138% of the poverty level? I mean, that's a big sticking point. And then anything they come up with, they still got to work with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to get waivers and to get, you know, approval for the plan. To make sure that they are going to get the match that they want. And then the other big problem that they're going to have is that the House leadership has to come up with something that they can take to the caucus and get approval from the Republican caucus, which was very, I wouldn't even say ambivalent, but they were resistant. They were hostile, I guess, toward the Healthy Utah plan that Governor Herbert put out. So there are still a lot of boxes they're going to need to check to get this done. And Representative Dunnigan, who is the majority leader of the House, you know, and does have some clout, but he says he wants to get this, get something. He's hoping that they can get something ready to go by the time the legislature meets again in January. And then even after they, assuming they pass it and Governor signs it, then there's like a period of several months, about 6 months, where it would take them to ramp it up. And so we're looking a long ways down the road before we actually see anything where the rubber meets the road.
And yet, Kristen, you're reporting that Senator Shiozawa still has some rose-colored glasses on this issue. He's optimistic that something can be hammered out.
You know, both he and Dr. Patton yesterday, who spoke to the Health Reform Task Force, which Dunnigan co-chairs, both of them seemed more optimistic than Dunnigan that they'll be able to come to some agreement. And it almost sounded like sooner than Dunnigan was talking. Almost like, I think it was that Senator Shiozawa said, well, the governor, it's going to be up to the governor to call a special session when he wants to. They were asked directly when they expect to have a plan. Nobody answered the question, but both of them seemed more optimistic that it would be sooner than Representative Dunnigan was saying, you know, which is next session. You know, a lot of advocates are saying that if it waits till next session, they expect nothing to happen because by then it will be what, like Robert just said, it would take 6 months to even start it, and then it will be Obama leaving the White House. So, you know, whether if they wait till next session there will be any resolution at all, you know, is a real big question.
Well, certainly an emotional issue and a complicated one that you'll continue to follow. Let's move on to another emotional issue. Lawmakers heard this week the most detailed report yet of Research on Medical Marijuana. Kristen, fill us in. What's involved in the study with kids with epilepsy up at the University of Utah?
Well, this study, it took a long time to get it organized because it involved two federal agencies, the FDA and the DEA. So Ed Clark, who's head of pediatrics, reported the other day to the legislature's Health and Human Services Committee that the study, which began late last year, has 25 kids in it. They have intractable epilepsy. They had many, many more kids who would have liked to participate. They had to limit it to that, maybe because of the federal restrictions. Anyway, so they've been giving them the drug that's developed in England by a company called GW Pharmaceuticals, and the drug is Epidiolex. It's a cannabidiol, which is CBD, part of marijuana, but it's not the part that gets people high. Anyway, they give it to these kids with epilepsy, 25 milligrams per kilo of weight every day for 12 weeks, and they monitor them. And Ed Clark said that more than half of the kids had significant seizure reductions or serious, I guess, duration and frequency of their seizures reduced. So he was quite confident that it's a good result. He said there were some minor side effects. However, the same drug is being tested at 10 other sites, other universities, and one child had liver failure. So as he was saying, it's not, you know, a perfectly harmless pharmaceutical. It really does need to be tested, but he's confident that it's a good result and may, you know, eventually result in a FDA-approved drug that kids with epilepsy can use.
Hmm. We also heard
from marijuana.
In addition to the research, we heard from legislators on both sides who are pushing a bill to legalize medical marijuana. Senator Mark Mattson is staunchly behind that. And we also heard some more personal accounts from patients who swear by marijuana's ability to ease chronic pain, right?
Right. I mean, some of them have used it and have found that to be true. Others of them have just, you know, read and heard accounts of people and want to be able to use it. Though it's interesting how some of these people are willing to really put themselves out there. There's a woman with MS, 35 years old, who admitted in this public forum that she uses pot, and she didn't claim she was going out of state to get medical marijuana. And she told me afterward, yeah, I'm buying it on the black market and using it, and it's making all the difference in my life. I'm able to walk much better. She's out of her wheelchair more often. She's more engaged in life. She says it's doing great things for her. There was a father whose daughter has a very serious form of epilepsy. He's from southern Utah. And he said that the medical marijuana they're shipping into the state under a waiver that's, you know, legal through the state, hemp extract, that's really helping his daughter with marijuana, so, or with her epilepsy. There is an increasingly organized group of people pushing for this. They're having forums all around the state. And they're getting a lot of traction. Of course, you'll probably remember there were surveys last winter that the majority of Utahns do not oppose medical marijuana. Anyway, Senator Mattson said his bill is already 57 pages long, which is interesting. And it was revealed for the first time that there's going to be another medical marijuana bill. Senator Vickers from Cedar City, who happens to be a pharmacist, is proposing, he said that he and Representative Brandaugh are working on a plan that would be less ambitious than Mattson's bill.
So we're hearing a lot of stories, support for medical marijuana, and yet the opponents to legalizing marijuana are certainly waiting. Robert, I mean, how's this going to play politically?
Well, I mean, it's still a tough sell, and what we saw with Senator Mattson last session was that he had really not done the homework, particularly on the House side, to kind of sell this to the representatives. So, you know, and his bill then was a little bit hastily put together. He's trying to take some time, and that's why we're sort of seeing this process play out now. And so, you know, there was, I would say, fairly staunch resistance, particularly in the House. I mean, of course, in the Senate, it just failed by a vote. But didn't get the traction in the House, and so he's going to have some work to do to try to sell this plan. And that's again part of what this process is. It's a refining process for the bill itself. It's also sort of to kind of calm jittery nerves among some of the House members. One of the dynamics of this that we probably need to keep in mind when we get back into session next year in January is that it's going to be an election year. And going out there and voting to legalize pot in an election year may not be a popular vote for a lot of these Republican representatives who are going to be seeking re-election.
Between medical marijuana and healthy Utah, it should be shaping up to be quite
be a
session.
Busy time. Yeah.
Kristen Moulton, I got to let you go. Thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
You bet. It was fun. Thanks. Bye.
Kristen Moulton, a health reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. Again, join us, 801-355-TALK, if you have a perspective on the week's news. Let's move to another top story this week. A federal court judge handed a lesbian couple in Utah a win, a big win, in an adoption case. Jennifer Dobner, tell us about Angie and Cammie Rowe.
So the Rose married in December of 2013 on the day that a different federal judge made same-sex marriage legal in Utah. And then they decided that they wanted to have a child. So through the use of sperm donation, they had baby Lucy in February. She's 5 months old now. And the state has a... Under the Utah Parentage Act, has a requirement that if you conceive a child through the use of donated sperm, you have to consent. The male, the husband, has to consent in writing, but he's automatically made the legal parent of that child on a birth certificate.
So that's current state law.
What the federal judge said on Wednesday was that's discrimination, because a lesbian couple, the Rose, who sued, were being required to pursue a second parent adoption. And they said we shouldn't have to go through all those hoops, spend the money, have a home study, go to a judge and have a judge say, approve us as parents. They said that was discriminatory, and the federal courts agreed.
How significant is this decision for gay and lesbian couples?
Well, it only applies to women. Surrogacy that like a gay men would use is in a different part of the statute, and so it doesn't apply here. So
okay.
It only applies to married lesbian couples who have a baby through, artificial insemination with the use of a sperm donor. But it is significant. There are other cases like this around the country. The ACLU says, they say this is precedent setting. And interestingly, it would be the third precedent setting ruling related to the LGBT community to come out of Utah in 18 months.
George, what does that say about Utah in the LGBT rights battle?
Well, yeah, if you were going to look back, 5 years ago and then forecast forward and say, gee, I wonder where all the crucial gay rights, marriage equality cases, what state will they all come out of? Utah? Nah,
right,
I don't
the last
think
place.
So. But, of course, as I tell a lot of people who don't live around here and ask me about it, I don't live in Utah. I live in Salt Lake City. It is like Hong Kong or West Berlin is just a totally different place. And so that's where the activism is coming out of. But, I mean, especially after first the Kitchen case and then the case where the United States Supreme Court said gay marriage was a 14th Amendment flat, unassailable right in every state of the Union, I think it's really kind of embarrassing that the state even fought this. And they said, because as the great philosopher Groucho Marx once said, according to our mother, you're our father, and that's good enough for us. Well, in this case, according to our mother, she's also our mother, and that's good enough for us. The state ought to just recognize this. And even the hint that they might appeal this decision is just absurd and, in my mind, cruel. The judges ruled it's the only possible interpretation you can have after the Supreme Court ruling, which we dropped all that money on. And I guess we're trying to go back and justify having spent all that money. They're not going to find that.
George Pyle from the Tribune, editorial
yes,
page.
This is the editorial
Jennifer
section
Doudna.
Well, what I was going to say is, in fact, that on June 26th, the day that the United States Supreme Court legalized gay marriage for the nation, Judge Benson here in Utah asked both the state and the ACLU, who sued on the Roe's behalf, to tell him how, in light of the SCOTUS decision, you know, he couldn't rule in favor of the couple. And the state really was not able to do that. They were asked repeatedly Wednesday at the hearing, tell me why this isn't discrimination, why making a woman do something different than a man isn't discrimination. And they couldn't. Their arguments were, number one, two parts of the statute apply. Under the part that looks at vital records, we need to have accurate vital records. And you can't say in any circumstance that a woman is the father, and which is, of course, the way the forms read. But that seems like a technicality, I guess, to some people. The other part of the argument was that this is about family stability, that we need the legal process so that children have certainty about which adults are responsible for them and committed to them. And the judge basically said, yeah, it's still discrimination to make a woman do something different than a man. And it was quite unusual in that he ruled from the bench, which I don't think anyone was expecting. it almost seemed like a half-hearted argument on the state's part. So
will they appeal?
Well, I asked that question, and Parker Douglas, who's the Solicitor General for Utah and argued for the state, said he really had to go back to the office and have that conversation. I don't know. They have a track record of appealing. Certainly they did with the Robert Shelby ruling that legalized marriage. When they lost at the 10th Circuit on marriage, they appealed that. So I don't know. Clearly, the Obergefell decision from the U.S. Supreme Court in June changes the game. And this is what the ACLU argued. There's no question that what that ruling said is, under the 14th Amendment, everybody's equal. You can't have different rules. And the judge agreed. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, if they have anything left after that $1.2 million they spent on the marriage case, it wouldn't surprise me, because ideology is caught up in this conversation in Utah and lots of other places.
We're going to get to that cost in just a second. Well, but
I just throw in, too, that Attorney General Reyes has made a big point of it's his obligation to defend state laws. And if you follow that logic through, then he would be obligated to appeal this and try to defend the state law. And so I think it's probably likely that you'd see that, because otherwise they're going to have some explaining to do, unless as Jennifer mentioned, the Supreme Court decision just makes it sort of a moot point now.
Well, I do think one thing, and we talked about this with the state attorneys on Wednesday, this is a place where it shines light on something that's in state statute related to marriage and family, in which throughout the code, the references are to man, woman, husband, wife. So that conversation is an active conversation already, we know, in Utah, in light of the Supreme Court ruling. So we would have to look again to another busy session in January in which people are addressing marriage and family law to see what tweaks need to be made or don't need to be made in order to level the playing field for all families and all couples. Right.
The governor's office, we reported, I think, last week that they've identified about 4 or 5 dozen sections of state code where they are going to have to make changes, because it's some places it says husband or wife, and in which case it gives you a little wiggle room. It applies equally whether it's a same-sex couple or a heterosexual couple. But yeah, there's a number of sections that are explicit, the vital records section being a key part of it. And they said they're going to have to make some changes. So again, as Jennifer mentioned, there's going to be a lot of things to work out come January.
Yeah, but we've had letters and comments online where people have said, this is simple. You go on your computer, you do search and replace. You know, every time it says husband or wife, you tell the computer to change it to spouse. You know, takes, you know, 14-year-old who knows how to work your computer, and it takes you a minute and a half, and you're done. And it does kind of depend on, are you ready to go with this? Are you ready to recognize this? Are you ready to live under the Supreme Court ruling? Or are you going to go kicking and screaming all the way?
I mean, I think clearly we see around the country places like Texas who want to fight the Supreme Court ruling and find a way to not issue marriage licenses to gay couples. So I guess, you know, we've been living, really gay marriage has been legal in Utah since October 6th of 2014. I don't know if opponents of that can really make an argument, you know, can make the arguments that they used to make, which is that it threatens, you know, heterosexual marriage or it's not good for children. So we'll just have to see how the ideology wins out or doesn't come January, I guess.
People can be remarkably creative when you tell them they have to stop discriminating.
This is true. History has shown us this, but that, you know, gives me something to do next year,
yeah,
I guess,
yeah.
That I can count on.
Well, how many years since Brown versus the Board? And there are a lot of places still fighting that.
Well,
so,
how many years since the Civil Rights Movement?
Yes.
And I think we've seen recently that...
Yeah.
That conversation isn't over either.
No,
so
no.
Time. Jennifer mentioned the appeal of the same-sex marriage ban. This week you reported, Robert, that the state spent a nice chunk of change on defending Utah's marriage ban. This week we found out how much.
Yeah, they end up spending $1.2 million on the appeals. A large chunk of that was to hire outside counsel. They hired a gentleman named Gene Scher and a guy named John Bursch. Those were the two primary outside attorneys. They also, for a period of time, had Monty Stewart working on the case. And so they spent $500,000 paying those three gentlemen, Gene Scher being the lead on it. And then they also spent about $700,000 on internal staff attorney time on the case. They had budgeted, the legislature had budgeted $500,000 for it, so they went well over budget, obviously, but the Attorney General's office basically has to, you know, eat the cost on that. So a lot of the money was spent, again, like I said, on, you know, people who already work for the Attorney General's office maybe being pulled off of other things and working, spending time on that, getting briefs in order and things like that. There was some discussion about whether the money was well spent, given the fact that the state lost the case on appeal. And, you know, the Sutherland Institute said, yeah, they, you know, trying defending a fundamental building block of society is always money well spent. And even Troy Williams from Equality Utah said, you know, if with the outcome being that marriage is now legal in Utah, yeah, it's money well spent. You know, it gave closure and clarity to the issue. So that's that's the bill that the tab the taxpayers are going to be paying paid to find the answer to this question that was asked.
Okay, before our time is ticking away, I want to quickly go to another big story that happened this week: the Boy Scouts of America announcing a major policy shift. And Jennifer, recap for us.
Yeah, they. Their executive committee passed a resolution that would end the ban on gay leaders in the Scouts. Currently, you can be a gay Boy Scout as a participant, but you can't be in a leadership position. So adult gay males are banned from that. We started hearing about an inkling of this change about a month ago when former Defense Secretary Robert Gates gave a speech that said he thought it was an untenable position to maintain. The proposal as it stands right now would allow for local groups, local communities, and primarily religions, because many Boy Scout troops are sponsored through religious organizations like the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints,
mm-hmm.
To sort of apply local rule. So if it's not a fit with your culture, you could continue to impose a ban. There's going to be a vote on that by the whole National Executive Board on July 27th, so in about 10 days. And I don't know, but I would suppose it would likely pass. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons here in Utah, they're the largest single religious sponsor of Boy Scout troops. Two high-ranking Mormons, Jeffrey Holland from the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles and Stephen Owen, who's the young men's president, both sit on the board. I think most people feel like this is a policy that the church could live with because it allows them to preserve their moral position on homosexuality. So, but it would be a dramatic shift across the nation for a lot of people.
Even though, in a practical sense, George, the BSA position won't really affect how Scouts works within the church. What about the perception among practitioners that that the BSA is open to having gay leadership?
Well, I mean, the national level, Secretary Gates has argued, it's an untenable position. You're going to be subject to a lot of lawsuits. But what they decided to do, instead of telling every council they have to do it our way, which used to be the way it was. Every council has to do it our way. Now every council can do it their way. It could be easier for places like the Mormon sponsor. It could be more difficult because then it becomes easier for somebody who might want to sue them to come in and say, well, your national council doesn't say you have to ban gay leaders, so you've made the decision to ban gay leaders, so you are discriminating. But it's also a private organization. They can do anything they want. And then in California, though, because they discriminate and because discrimination was part of their charter, they were getting thrown out of schools. They couldn't meet in schools anymore. Judges in California aren't allowed to be scoutmasters anymore because the organization discriminates. Well, now that's being taken away, so they'll have that back again. But in the short term, in a lot of communities, it'll probably just be business as usual. But it also serves to point out how some councils are different and, in the minds of some people, horribly retrograde.
One Utahn tried to get a troop affiliated with Utah mm-hmm. Pride Center. He was turned down by the Great Salt Lake Council. Trying again?
Peter Brownstein, yeah, he's been trying for several years. And, of course, he did again this year march in the Gay Pride Parade with his family in their scout uniforms. I think he sees this as an opening. We've had this conversation a couple of times. He sees it as an opening door for the conversation. I don't think anyone expects this to change overnight here in Utah, but I think anytime there's movement, people do feel encouraged. So I think we'll see a renewal of that dialogue.
We need to scoot to another break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with Robert Gerke, Jennifer Dobner, Christopher Smart, and George Pyle. Time for our underplayed story of the week. And Dobner, I'll start with you. What you got?
Well, I will say it's not underplayed because it's on the front page today. but the Utah Pride Center appointed a new executive director yesterday, Marion Edmonds Allen. They have been without a permanent director for 2 years. The last one resigned amid some allegations of mismanagement. Some people say this is an organization adrift without a vision. So it'll be interesting to watch sort of how Edmonds Allen sets a new course for this agency and how they grow in the community. She wants to make it a statewide resource, a real statewide resource, because people in Salt Lake City have a lot of support and a lot of help, but people, you know, downstate and in the far corners of Utah may not. So
that's a good story. George Pyle, what's your pick?
Cool story of the week, about as unlocal as you can get. 9 years probe flew by Pluto, missed its appointed rounds by 79 seconds.
I love that
story.
That's
pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. Christopher Smart.
News flash for all you duffers out there. If you want to play Wing Point Golf Course, you got to play it by November 1st. The Airport Authority Board is closing that baby down.
Oh, poor golf courses. Gerke, what you got?
The Utah Senate this week confirmed Stan Lockhart to fill a vacancy on the state school board. And he's the husband of late speaker Becky Lockhart. And he was appointed by the governor. And it kind of creates an interesting dynamic, because there was a pretty even split on the school board before on how much control they want to give to the governor in terms of budgeting and so forth. And so now, with one more member on the, from the governor's appointment, it may shift that balance a little bit.
Okay. Robert Gerke, you wrote my pick, which is the Hank Williams Jr. concert review at Red Butte Garden. If you haven't seen it, the Confederate flags are waving. It's
good old time. South shall rise again.
Yeah. Those good old boys. Robert Gerke, Jennifer Dobner, Christopher Smart, George Pyle, thank you all so much for your time today.
See you later.
You.
See you later. We'll wrap up this week with Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. And this week, he's got fireworks on his mind.
Anybody who's read more than three of my columns knows that I'm addicted to things that blow up. And back, when I was just out of high school, that was the place where you get the best stuff. That stuff left over there, military surplus stuff, seemed like.
You wrote about a little road trip that you took with your friend to go get some fireworks.
Yeah, this was back in 2003. Bammer and I took a trip up to Evanston. We told our wives we were going somewhere else. And then we went to Evanston to get fireworks. And in the column I wrote, it was risky. When we pulled into the parking lot of the fireworks stand, the place was packed with cars from Utah. Bammer swears he saw his boss's Oldsmobile. Granted, not all of the cars with Utah tags were necessarily there to purchase fireworks. I myself sometimes drive all the way to Idaho to purchase milk. And in this case, the fireworks stand was also a liquor store. Actually, the word stand brings to mind the shoddy joints back home, places that sell stuff no more dangerous than common flatulence. This place was the Walmart of boom. They had stuff left over from the first Gulf War. Perhaps because it was a magical place for two guys who never completely matured, we did not see anyone who looked like they saw us. We were busy reliving our childhood, but this time properly equipped.
Do you think that Utah should alter its fireworks restrictions? Because so many Utahns do go to Evanston to pick up some real spectacular fireworks.
It may have been okay in a different time, you know, say back in the 80s when we got more rain than we ever wanted. But not anymore. I mean, I'm older now and I understand the liability of setting something on fire. And that's something somebody in Utah has to learn every week between the 4th of July and the 24th of July. Seems like somebody sets some huge fire.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can read a lot more Kirby online at sltrib.com. Thanks so much for tuning in to Behind the Headlines today, and thanks especially to Jesse Ellis and the KCPW team. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening and joining us, and have a great weekend.